Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
Another huge one here coming for Adebayo. Do they take Duncan Robinson off the floor right now? I think that would make sense, you would think.
With two timeouts left, I would.
Huge free throws. Denver just collapsed right at the end of the clock. They're back in the man-to-man, switching everything here. They don't want to give up a three. Jokic at the foul line against Vincent. Goes through him and rolls it in. Again, they go through Vincent. Three-point game. So they're going to defend
here. Denver's not like, you try some sort of pressure there.
You would think, right? But there haven't been any timeouts to set that up. It's Gordon on Butler, waving everyone away. 10 to shoot. They're just going to switch this now with Jokic on Butler. Good help off the nail by Brown. Butler stepping back. Misses it. Here comes Denver. 10 seconds to go. Murray picked up by Vincent. He could maybe shoot over him. Switch. Butler going for the three. Murray stepping back to tie. Short.
Oh.
Rebounded by Martin. And we have a 1-1 series.
Woof. Wow. What a fourth quarter for Miami. Final numbers on that, 36-25 in favor of the Heat. They win it by three. We will see you on Wednesday for Game 3. Oh, baby.
Well, well. The Denver Nuggets fought back. Miami had a fantastic start. That was well in the rearview mirror. Miami did tie it in the third quarter at 66. Then Denver goes on a run in the dreaded Cody Zeller minutes. They lead 83-75 at the end of the third quarter. Looks like they would be in control. But as has happened so many times in these playoffs, au contraire, said the Miami Heat, we have a series.
We do. And there were so many phases of game two, and we'll get into a fair amount of them here. But I think the place to start is, and we'll talk about, I think, whether this is a true shift defensively for the Miami Heat, but the difference between Nikola Jokic's games one and two. So in game one, Jokic, not only he put up a triple-double, but he had 14 assists and only two turnovers. In game two, Jokic had a big scoring game, 41 points, 28 field goal attempts, more than twice as many as he had in game one, but only four assists compared to five turnovers. They made him a scorer, and he scored, but the team didn't score as much.
Yeah, the five turnovers was big too. They did manage to put more pressure on him, and I do not recall them coming with like a single hard double team at all. And the other thing that they did was they really tried to keep Bam Adebayo attached to him pretty well. I thought Bam, yeah, he scored 41 points. It's hard to say this, but Bam did a great job. He didn't let him get, I think there was only one, and this was against Zeller, like one little like cut for Jokic. He earned pretty much every bucket that he got. A few of them were like open pick and pop threes, but they're okay giving those up. And so Bam getting through those screens, like getting into his body. A few centers are able to do that, and Bam was able to do it when Jokic caught the ball. Generally, he was always there, at least in the first three quarters before they went to the vaunted zone defense. And yeah, to only give up four assists, Denver didn't shoot incredibly well in this one. They finished 11 to 28 from three. Two of those ended up being heaves, and they made three of their last four, but it wasn't incredibly damaging. And some of the shots that they might have made, like Porter Jr., who usually gets assisted by Jokic, he was one out of six again in this one. And they made it difficult enough, like 16 to 28. Like, that's survivable. Seven of eight from the line, that's more than you'd like to give up. But again, with five turnovers, four assists. Now, maybe too much just focus is going to be on that, because Denver still had an amazing offensive rating. Some of that came in those desperation last few minutes as they were trying to come back from a 12-point deficit under 4 minutes to go. And they did really get slowed down in the fourth quarter. But I think it was the things that you didn't see. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing, really. You talked about the passing from Jokic. Denver leads the NBA in passes into the paint for baskets. And they really, I mean, how many of those did they get in this game? Maybe like two or three? I'm trying to think. Can you think of many?
Not very many. And I mean,
Gordon had a couple of alley-oops. I can't think of much else.
Not a ton. I mean, I'm sure we missed some just overall in the shuffle, but relative to their normal standard, it was definitely fewer. And another point on this, Bob Lagares tweeted this out, is that Denver attempted 28 three-pointers in this game, but 11 of them were in transition or on second chance opportunities. And there wasn't a ton of transition in this game. So what that meant was Denver's half-court offense was not generating the volume of three-pointers that it normally does. And when you have really good three-point shooters, even if some of them missed more than they do, most notably MPJ, as you mentioned. So that puts Denver in a different situation. So they're not getting the stuff around the basket, as you brought up, those kind of those high efficiency opportunities, and they're not taking threes at that volume. They took six corner threes in the game. Miami took nine. So then it can be shot making, it could be a couple other things, but it's harder, generally speaking.
Now, the bigger story to me with Denver putting up a 124 offensive rating, and so much is going to be lost because this is an incredibly slow-paced game with only 86 possessions and only 19 possessions in the fourth quarter, which would be a 76 possession game. That's like a late 90s style of pace there, is that Miami's offense was great too. They put up a 129. And what will also be lost is they took a ton of threes and they made them. In some of these games, they haven't been taking that many threes, but they're 17 of 35 tonight. That was 44% of their shots. And so they're getting up a ton of threes and they're making a ton of them. They also shot 18 more free throws, 14 of them courtesy of Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, by the way, which we'll get to a little bit more. But I had talked about how in game one, Miami, if they played as well as they played in some of these games against Milwaukee and Boston, that they would win games in this series. And in game one, they were awful. Butler couldn't do anything. He was not great in this game either, but he did a lot more with nine assists and he helped close the game. Bam was much better as well. He was much more efficient. They didn't go to this, like, let's let Bam Adebayo shoot 25 free throw line jumpers offense. Gabe Vincent was 4-6 from three. Strus makes four in the first quarter. And then Duncan Robinson basically was the Heat offense, getting them 13 points in less than 3 minutes, I believe, in the game-changing run at the start of the fourth. So they came out, and while the Nuggets could have been a lot better, Miami, except for maybe that stretch at the end of the first, beginning of the second, when they made a lot of mistakes, they played really well. Like, that's the thing. Like, this really... I didn't think that Denver, they had some mistakes, sure, but they still were really good offensively. Like, they are a machine. Like, it's really hard to shut down this Nikola Jokic offense. But Miami, they played great. Like, they made a lot of great plays in this game, and that's why they won, as it was in, going back to the Boston series and the Milwaukee series. And that really heartens me to see the Heat play at that level, at least for one game in this series. And that makes me think that we may have a series and there isn't some magic that Denver is going to be able to just completely shut them down the way they did in game one.
One of the biggest surprises in the game, and I don't want it to be overemphasized considering he only played 22 minutes, but in part, presumably, because Caleb Martin was dealing with an illness, he did not practice on Saturday. Martin came off the bench and they started Kevin Love, who got a DNP coach's decision in game one, starts, plays 22 minutes, and pretty much just the opening of the first and third quarters is primarily when he played. But I want to give Kevin Love a lot of credit because he is still a limited defensive player. And you could see that at different times. Like, there was a play where he was contesting on Jokic and did really contest on Jokic. But Love not only was in position most of the time, did some really good second and third effort work beyond the defensive glass that surprised me. That you know, like, he was in places and was affecting shots. And so I thought if Love started, and, you know, talked about this when we were setting up the game on playback, that if Love played, it was going to be him guarding Jokic, Bam as the rover. We basically did not see that at all.
No, they were terrified to have him on Nikola Jokic, to the point where some of their best offense with him in the game was running a 5-4 pick and roll and eventually forcing Love to step up. But he actually really worked well as a help defender, and I'm sure Jokic would like to have a few of these back, but Love actually kind of got in there, like, bothered Jokic a little bit. He was looking to take charges. He took an early one on MPJ curling into the lane. And while he was only 2 of 6 from three, I thought that his ability to space out was important on the offensive end. He had 7 defensive rebounds in 22 minutes and was plus 18. It was basically like the best plus minus per minute on Miami. So it shockingly worked. And part of that was just that Love actually, like, he probably made like 5 or 6 real rim protecting plays. He had 2 steals and just like, it wasn't necessarily shot blocked, but he was just able to kind of get his chest in front of guys, get a hand in a little bit, bother Jokic. He might make those shots in the future, but like, he was good. I couldn't believe it. It was really an impressive performance by him.
March is over, but the biggest moments in college basketball tip off the month of April. Be a part of the action on Prize Picks for both men's and women's college basketball. You can win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks as you and the world's best players take the game to a new level during basketball's postseason. You can get in on the action in more than 30 states across the country, including California, Texas, and Georgia, and win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks with as little as 4 correct picks. It's really simple to play. On America's number one fantasy sports app, you can make your picks and submit your entry in less than 60 seconds. Right now, they've got basketball, college basketball, and hockey entries available today on Prize Picks. It's exceedingly easy to make your entries. You look at the player projections, you select more or less, and you can turn $10 into $1,000 on what is, once again, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today and use the code CAPSPACE. Easy to remember CAPSPACE because we talk about it all the time here on the program. For a first deposit match of up to $100, that's code CAPSPACE. For a first deposit match up to $100, pick more, pick less. It's that easy. And don't forget that CAPSPACE code to let them know you came from us. Oh, it is that time again. Wedding season. Indochino's custom suits will have you walking into a wedding looking like $1 million, feeling like $1 million, because their suits are custom made to fit you perfectly. You can get a tailored fit from the comfort of your home. You can set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website, choose customizations without even leaving the house. Indochino was the official outfitter of my wedding. I got a tux from them. All my groomsmen got custom fitted sport jackets, and I'd like to think we all look great. Order your custom suit now. Be ready for wedding season, whether it's at home or in person at a showroom near you, which I actually recommend. That's what I did. An Indochino style guy can walk you through all of the amazing customizations that they have. The lapels, the lining, single-breasted, double-breasted. You can feel the fabrics in person. That's definitely the best way to do it, in my opinion. But you can also do it from home as well. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com. Use that familiar CAPSPACE code to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com. I-N-D-O-C-H-I-N-O. Indochino.com. Don't forget that CAPSPACE code to let them know you came from us.
On the other side of the coin, especially Michael Porter Jr., it was such a disappointing performance from him, because MPJ had maybe the best defensive game I've ever seen from him in game one, and did great as a help defender, was reacting, was active, and then was truly terrible in on defense. And he missed more shots than you expect. That, there's a regression of the mean, but it was about defensive execution. And you could see the way that Kentavious Caldwell-Pope interacted with him, was looking at Michael Porter Jr. That was telling a lot of that story, let's put it that way.
Yeah, a lot of miscommunications by Denver, and particularly early on Strus. I think 3 of his threes in that first quarter came off of miscommunications. I believe all of them involved Porter Jr., and at least 2 of them were his fault, if not all 3 of them. And those plays are hard to deal with, and with Strus actually making his shots, that was a big part of it. And we saw the Celtics also struggled to deal with those ghost screens, even though Michael Malone talked about it pregame. They didn't have a great plan on it. They did much better once they got to the second unit with Brown, Christian Brown, and Bruce Brown out there. Jeff Green did a good job of switching, and KCP out there a lot with the second unit as well. But yeah, it was disappointing. And then he really had a chance to hit some big threes and was 2 for 11 in game one, 1 of 6 in this one. But and particularly against the zone, it really would have been nice if he could have hit some shots or gotten open for some shots, and it wasn't in the cards for him.
Well, and tonight, and one way of telling the Michael Porter Jr. story in this game is that he logged significant minutes in both the first and third quarters, and then barely played at the end of the second when the Nuggets go on this big run, and then he only played 5 minutes in the fourth quarter as well. And he only played 5 minutes in the fourth quarter. In part, he got roughly, let's call it a minute and a half of that, was because KCP fouled out. He wasn't in the original closing five. He just was a replacement in the closing five.
So Miami gets off to the good start that they needed, 10-2, a couple of Strus threes. He was so bad in that game one. I think he was 0-for-9. Didn't hit a three, of course, because that's what that zero means. And then they come in with Cody Zeller and Duncan Robinson simultaneously, and that really became a big problem for Miami defensively, with Jokic still closing things out. They elected again to not have Bam mirror Nikola Jokic's minutes. I think that's probably a mistake, but I mean, they did win the game, so you can't argue that much. And the unit with Bam at the start of the fourth with no Jimmy did change the game, and that Spo does have a theory to these lineups, so it's not so obvious here, but certainly that hurt them in the first. Robinson couldn't get going at all. He was getting denied by Christian Brown really well, and Brown was good with a couple of steals. I think he was 3 of 3 in the first half, including a fadeaway over Bam from the right elbow, which apparently is just a spot where no matter how difficult the shot over Bam is, it's just going to go in for the Denver Nuggets. They had a bunch of crazy ones. And I thought that Zeller, again, was just kind of like, he had a play where in transition, not even in transition, where they're just trying to pressure up full court, and he sort of leaned over towards Murray, and so Jokic just cut right behind him at half court and went in. And I thought he tried gamely, but Jokic clearly had more confidence working against him in the post, and particularly because Murray is out during those minutes, they will go to Jokic more. So yeah, Denver goes on a crazy run. I think it ended up being 27-6 at one point. They lead by 12.
I think it was like 40-14 at one point. It was...
Yeah. I mean, Miami led by double digits, and then Denver got up to a double digit lead. And I thought Miami's passing also was really poor. They had, I think, 4 turnovers in like the first 4 or 5 minutes of the second quarter as that run was being made by Denver. Again, this is all with Jokic off the floor, Jimmy as well. But yeah, they really were throwing it all over the gym. Bam took a couple of bad shots when he just had a wide open guy on the weak side for threes. I mean, isn't it amazing, Danny, like the difference between Bam when he's standing still as a passer and Bam when he's like moving towards the basket?
It is. And there were times where we wondered about how long that would be the case. But yeah, that's been a part of the story, at least so far.
Another thing that was really good was Jeff Green's post game, which he did like 3 times. And yeah, I guess he's going to go left shoulder every time. He went for a hook shot in game one. I was like, let's see if he's got anything else. He probably doesn't. But that caused me to look up his post game during the broadcast. He goes left shoulder 67% of the time, usually to a hook shot. But he was just running the floor hard, getting matched up against a smaller guy like Robinson or Vincent, and either drawing fouls or collapsing the defense. I thought Miami also just, even Kyle Lowry had just some overly aggressive closeouts on Christian Braun, one where he just blew in for a layup when they closed out hard against him above the break, which I don't think he's hit him above the break 3 since February at this point. So it looked like, oh, well, Miami is going to fall apart. Like, they're not going to play very well. And then they are able to get back into it a little bit late second and then tie it up at 66 earlier in the third.
You mentioned it in passing, but I wanted to follow up on it. Like, what are the most stunning parts of game two was the volume of fouls on 3-point shots. A lot of those were on Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, including one where he complained about it vociferously, but it was the right call, where Kyle Lowry moves forward on his jump shot and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope didn't really contest the shot. But the more egregious one to me was on Max Strus. It was a late clock.
Oh, God.
Late clock. Strus is just kind of heaving it up. And KCP didn't even go for a block. He just went for a strip with like 1 second left on the shot clock. It was going to be a bad look.
And it was a 31 footer, like going to his left with him right there. Just put your hand up and live to fight another day.
And the situation got even worse for KCP because he did foul out. I mean, it's not like he played great in the game and was 1 for 4 from the field, other than I believe he had his own 3-shot foul. That was the Gabe Vincent one. But it was jarring because I mean, KCP has earned his reputation as a defensive player, but and had some really good possessions where he like hustled and deflected a ball or got back and made a great read. But then those 3-shot fouls in particular, like that was an outright majority of Miami's free throws.
What did you make of Jimmy Butler's game, accepting the end? When he was pretty good in pick and roll for a couple of possessions that kept them at bay.
I thought that his thought process was better, you know, going after Jokic more consistently, more aggressively, and had a couple of big threes, which are always a little bit surprising, even though he's done it so much more now in the playoffs than the regular season. I think for me, this one wasn't as much like, oh, he's being tentative, he's being passive, as much as the shots just didn't fall for him at the rate that they did at other points in these playoffs. So I thought it was below his standard. But the other big part, and I think this is a key, we've talked about how Denver was, even though their offensive rating was still like well above average overall, Jimmy Butler made a huge difference on the defensive end.
Yeah, and the strategy from the jump was that he was going to guard Jamal Murray, but unlike what you might have thought, it wasn't, oh, we'll have him be able to switch onto Jokic. It was more just that he was going to get physical with Murray, try to get over screens. I think the biggest part of it was just that he could do more of a rear view contest. They just don't have anyone else with that type of length. Even Martin is really only about 6'5". And Butler doesn't have great length, but he's physical. He was able to stay close enough to the body of Murray, not pick up fouls. Bam definitely was a little bit more aggressive, I thought, as a pick and roll defender if Murray did turn the corner. But Bam has such long arms and he's so active, and he did a good job of disguising his intentions. If he did come over there to bother Murray, it was at a point where he was just on the axis between Murray and Jokic and made it really tough to get Jokic that pocket pass. And then they also would bring over guys from the weak side. They like to run a lot of kind of open side action with Jokic and Murray, and that enabled the Heat to bring some of their guys over as well. And then on Jokic, when it was Bam guarding Jokic in the post, or if Jokic did get some sort of a mismatch in transition or off a screen, I mentioned they didn't do the hard doubles, but they did bring the help when Jokic really made his move. And particularly if it looked like he was going to get right to a spot and get an easy layup or something like that. So they did find a way to help there. And even as good of a passer as Jokic is, when the help comes and you're right at the rim and it's not giving you a shot, that does make it a little bit harder to make a pass, because now you can't pass it to someone right under the rim because you're under the rim. And so Aaron Gordon then kind of becomes a little bit more useless, because Aaron Gordon isn't necessarily going to fly in like off of 1 foot necessarily for a finish. He's more of a 2 foot leaper. So they couldn't really get him the ball very well. And I thought Love was really good at this. And, you know, maybe you can try to kick out for a three at that point, but if you're right under the basket being double teamed, some of those angles can become a little bit more difficult. Again, Jokic was fantastic overall. Like, they didn't shut him down by any means, but it was, at least it wasn't just getting totally picked apart, and they did a better job with size. They also were able to get away with Strus guarding Aaron Gordon later on in the game, but that was maybe an underrated part of starting Kevin Love, was just they weren't going to duck in Aaron Gordon on Kevin Love. And so that would enable Jimmy to play on the perimeter. They tried to do that, remember, at the start of game one, or they got caught in cross matches probably more often, and that's when Gordon had that crazy 12-point first quarter. So everything was just a little bit tighter for Miami defensively, but really, again, it was the crazy offense. We should probably talk now, though, about after Jokic has 18 points in the third, they kill the Zeller minutes again. Michael Malone, we thought he might stick with Jokic right at the start of the fourth, but with an 8-point lead, I think he felt better about it than he did at the start of game one. And also, they're coming off the 90s, the rest, whatever it was. But then Duncan Robinson happened.
He did. And it was a mix of three-pointers. Of course, Duncan Robinson, fantastic at that overall. Two of, I believe, both of his three-point makes then, but also did some work inside the arc. He and set up another, the only basket in that really quick early stretch. It was a 10 or 11-0 run that he didn't score directly, was his gravity leading to a Heat teammate being wide open for a three.
Yeah, they ran, I think, three times in a row. Bam. In the slot on the left side, Gabe Vincent screening Robinson out of the corner and some split cut actions, and Robinson gets loose for a layup against a closeout. He beat Jamal Murray for six of those 10 points, which was pretty big. Murray didn't close out on him very well on one play and let him shoot it. Then Murray tried to close it down. He drives baseline as a lefty finish for an and one. And it basically, I mean, it happened all so fast to get those 13 points so quickly.
So I will be honest, I tend to pack on the pounds a little bit during the winter, holiday season, not getting outside as much. So in springtime, I try to eat healthier, and I'm really excited to try Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Each meal is fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. This is going to be fantastic for me during the playoffs, when a lot of times I feel like I don't have time to eat healthy, and now I can choose from a number of their delicious but healthy options. I like to go keto. On occasion, they have that. They have vegan and veggie options as well. Here's what they've got for their keto weekly menu this week. Sun-dried tomato chicken with zucchini noodles, spicy poblano beef bowl with roasted broccoli, chicken piccata with cauliflower, mashed and broccoli. Or if you want to go their chef's choice weekly menu, jalapeno lime cheddar chicken. That sounds fantastic. Greek lemon chicken with roasted potatoes. This all sounds really, really good. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up. Heat and savor the good stuff. And they're also celebrating Earth Day all month long as well. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/dunked50, special code for this one. That's factormeals.com/dunked50, and use the code dunked50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's code dunked50 at factormeals.com/dunked50, 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Renters, you ever feel like you're stuck in this loop of rent payments, just watching your money vanish into thin air? It's time to turn that rent game around and start earning some serious rewards. That's where Built Rewards comes in. Built is breaking ground as the first rewards program that hooks you up with points on your rent. Even if you're still rocking the old school rent check vibes, Built Rewards has got your back. They'll mail the check for you. It's like having a personal rent paying assistant. Every month, pay your rent and watch the Built points roll in. Use points to jet off on a dream vacation. Put your points towards a flight or hotel stay with 500 plus airlines and 700,000 plus hotels and properties. You can also use your points towards a future rent payment or towards a future down payment on a home. Pay rent hassle-free through the Built Rewards app. Your rent game just got a major upgrade. Earn points by paying rent right now when you go to joinbuilt.com/capspace. That's joinbuilt, B-I-L-T, joinbuilt.com/capspace. Don't forget that /capspace URL.
And of course, they're in the zone, so they're able to protect him a little bit more. When they went man with Duncan Robinson, then he got taken advantage of some, but not quite that much. And in the zone, he's on the baseline, and Denver doesn't really have a great package to try to go after him. They're more focused on trying to get it to Jokic in the middle of the zone. Then on the other end, Miami reoriented their zone even more to deal with Jokic at the foul line, where they really had whoever was there just like basically fronting him the entire time. And so even if that left, like they didn't, I talked to at the end of game one about how one guy would be guarding the ball, they'd swing it to the next pass, and then the guy guarding the ball would have to get back inside of Jokic to deny, and he couldn't do that. So instead, what they basically did was even more of kind of a 2-1-2 look if Jokic was at the foul line, and whatever guard was trying to deny him would just never leave him, even if the pass got made or a drive got made, and then they would just trust the guys behind him to try to make the play. On one of those, with an 11-point Heat lead, Bam Adebayo, pretty obviously goaltended, Jamal Murray. How did you feel about the refereeing in this game? Anything in particular?
I thought most of the three-shot fouls were, I mean, most if not all of them were correctly adjudicated. There were a few soft fouls called.
Well, the Jokic one, we never got a replay that, to me, showed any contact. I was surprised Spo didn't go for the challenge on that.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that. Overall, I thought it was fine. They called a couple of illegal screens, but they seemed illegal. There was one where KCP probably baited a little bit by going down when he was behind the play, but it was an illegal screen to begin with. So other than the pretty egregiously missed goaltend, I thought they did a good job.
Before we talk about the end of the game, Gabe Vincent was a game best plus 22 in this one in 32 minutes, 8 of 12, 4 of 6 from 3, made all 3 of his free throws, had 23 points, 3 assists, 2 steals. He did just get bludgeoned over and over by Jokic from the free throw line. I mean, that's part of the genius of Jokic, is that he's able to back down and get to where he wants to go and basically never commits an offensive foul, because he's able to make like quick spins or just use his bulk to work in a position legally or quasi-legally, using that forearm a little bit. And so he got a bunch of plays on Vincent, but Vincent came right back. He was good in pick and roll. He made a ton of threes that were some really tough ones. And like, he is quite the barometer for the Heat. He was good in game one also, but continues to really improve his free agent stock. And he just competes defensively. Another guy doesn't make mistakes. Even those plays on Jokic where he's kind of getting bulldozed or by Jaylen Brown or RJ Barrett in an earlier series, like, he's at least, it's not hopeless, right? Like, he's not just getting completely blown by, like, he's making him make mid-rangers that are a little bit difficult, at least making him make a couple of moves. He's not fouling, so... that was pretty good. So at one point, Miami is outscoring Denver 29-10 in the quarter, and ultimately they take a 12-point lead. Butler missing a mid-ranger, it bounced right back to him. There are a bunch of weird bounces on offensive rebounds that benefited both teams. Caleb Martin sprints to the left corner, somehow gets his feet beyond the line. He was ill, as you mentioned, only played 21 minutes, but closed it out. Hits a huge corner three, and as you said on the cast, we were in perfect game territory, and it was shockingly not that perfect that still got them a chance at the tying three at the end. But was there anything that really stood out to you from that end of the game?
Miami could, so part of a perfect game, you know, it's defense, threes, and three shot fouls. And there were a couple possessions where I thought the Heat gave up cleaner looks from three than I expected. Some of them were great shot making. Like, Jamal Murray had one that was like, all right, but maybe if he's going to do that, then what are you going to do? But like, they conceded a wide open Aaron Gordon three. That was what took it from 12 to 9. It's like, I understand that you want to maintain your defensive scheme. There also are very few ways that you're going to lose a game like that, and one of them is by giving up wide open threes.
Yeah, Denver goes 3 of 4. I'm sorry. No, that's incorrect, because KCP missed when they got the offensive rebound and set up Murray. So they go 3 of 5 on threes in that last stretch.
Without Michael Porter Jr. on the floor.
Murray hit a tough one at the mesh point of the screen right after Gordon had hit one. That cut it from 12 to 6 over the course of two possessions, and it looked like it was going to get interesting. Nonetheless, Denver only got one shot in the air to tie it, which was Murray's final three. And part of how Miami was able to do that, even though they only scored 4 points after that Martin three with 3:29 remaining, they didn't turn it over. They ran the time down nearly as far as you can on every possession. And they also extended the floor a little bit with their zone, forced Denver to use up some time as they came up. And so despite only scoring 4 points, which was barely enough, they got a Butler jumper and they got two Bam free throws.
When KCP jumped on, he jumped on a Bam pump fake, if memory serves, and then...
Well, I that wasn't what stood out to me on that play. I guess I can kind of get to that now, that the Heat late game offense now, and they missed a couple of shots. They're trying to run the time down, so make of this what you will. But I did think that they finally were able to take advantage of Jokic at least a little bit, mostly by getting him out on the floor. First, Butler hits that pull-up mid-ranger from the right side, and then they decide they're going to get him further up. Butler is about to shoot a three with just under a minute left, and Jokic gets out too far with like 5 on the shot clock. Butler finds the pass back to Bam as Jokic again goes for the steal. Jokic also got beaten on the pocket pass on that huge Bam dunk all over Michael Porter Jr. that happened with about 5 minutes to go. And so Jokic, I think he, with the way he's defended some of the shooters or when he's been up I think he needs to kind of stay tight. Like, his number one goal, I think, should be show, but also, like, make sure you're taking away the pocket pass. He trusts his hands a lot, and he has good hands, but a lot of times he'll, like, lunge for the ball, not get it, and now you've got a really more like a 3-on-2 going downhill with one of the better role men in BAM. So I did think he got taken advantage of some. I thought the Heat did a better job of at least attacking the rim some against Jokic, and it didn't look like they got to the rim a ton. There are some that got scored as, like, just outside the restricted area, but they were better than they were obviously in game number one. So that was the biggest thing strategically that stuck out to me in at the end of the game. But they only scored 4 points in the last 3.5 minutes, so you can't argue with the Nuggets defense too much there.
No, you can't. A couple other things towards the end of the game that were potentially important. One of them is that Miami is up after those two BAM free throws. They're up 5 with 48 seconds to go. And because none of them happened in the final 2 minutes, Malone does not use a timeout. They get the ball up, and it looked to me like Miami was making a more concerted effort not to give up a three there. And over the course of these playoffs, it has become clearer to me that you really do need to get the three first, if it's at all reasonably possible, because there's a reasonable chance that you're just not going to get a chance to tie or take the lead if you don't get that three-pointer up first. It's the idea of, you know, Seth has talked about this so well over the years, of losing more slowly. Jokic is better at getting twos than damn near everybody. And I mean, they got one and he made it, and they still had enough latitude to defend on that possession. But it was tough to get a good look at three, because on that last possession, the best that you can do if you take a two down five is a three-pointer that everyone knows is going to be a three-pointer.
Yeah, that's right. And Miami, credit them for switching, playing against the three there. That's how Jokic got Vincent on him for the 92nd time and just bludgeoned him into a short ranger. And it ended up taking 15 seconds off the clock as well. So they score 35. And then Denver actually comes back and switches Jokic onto Jimmy late in the clock, which I actually think is not that bad. Jokic is better than you'd expect as a switch guy, and Jimmy was forced into a tough step back three that he clearly didn't have the legs for. So they get the rebound, 11 seconds left, no timeout. What did you think of that?
As has been the case throughout these playoffs, going no timeout at the beginning of the possession, once it changes hands, so in this case that was about 11 seconds left. It was 14 when he shot, about 11 when Bruce Brown got the rebound. No problem there, because you have a chance. They might be scrambled, and in this case in particular, the Heat had defensive upgrades they could make, and the Nuggets didn't really have offensive upgrades that they could make. So you don't get that net personnel.
Well, the Heat did have their best.
Highsmith was not out there. Duncan Robinson was. Oh, no, Vincent had Duncan replaced Robinson him. Was not. Vincent had replaced him. Apologies. So from a kind of general thought process, I think that it's reasonable, as it was for Budenholzer and Mazzulla, and both of them got crushed for not calling timeouts in somewhat similar circumstances. I believe Budenholzer's was later in the clock than this was. In all three cases, though, the problem is that you don't call the timeout then, but you have to be extremely ready, both ideally coach and players involved, though the players are fundamentally optimistic most of the time, to call it when things aren't working. And that, to me, is where Malone made the mistake.
Yeah, now, the shot that they got by Murray, it was pretty online, just a little bit short.
And probably, he might have had a cleaner look before that, too.
At what point?
I think it was like 5 seconds left or something. There was a point where it's like, it would have been early, kind of like a meshy, if memory serves. You rewatched it more recently than I did.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, I guess I can comment on that. So I think the shot that they got in the end was pretty good. I don't think you have a right to expect getting a better look than that down three for the tie. Miami also actually had a foul to give, which I had forgotten at the time. And that might be a reason to not call the timeout. Because Miami, I think, had just forgotten that they had the foul to give. The process, though, wasn't great, and the Heat are kind of in transition after the Jimmy miss, and they didn't really match up well. They had Gabe Vincent on Murray, and then Jokic goes over to set the screen, and I'm not sure whether Jimmy intentionally picked up Jokic so he could switch, although Bama, of course, is quite capable of it as well. But Jokic brought Jimmy Butler, the superior defender, into the action to guard Murray when I thought Murray had the size advantage, as I noted in our call, on Vincent. And I was like, oh, he might be able to just shoot over Vincent. And Jokic, of course, you want him in the action. But I think that in the end turned out to be counterproductive because whoever was guarding Jokic was going to be a better option than Vincent. And Murray really could have, I thought, gotten, used his size advantage to get a good look against Vincent. And as it turned out, it was a solid look against Butler and just didn't go in the end. So what do you make of this series going forward?
It did require not only, you know, like kind of a comeback after the initial lead for Miami, but also very, very hot three-point shooting for them to win this game in Denver. But there were elements that you could see continuing moving forward. And Duncan Robinson having that big fourth quarter, Lowry had you know, a couple of moments, but, you know, like Strus looking more like Max Strus, Gabe Vincent having a good game, you know, those support players can be essential for Miami. And so there, we both believe that there were pathways for Miami to win this game and that they also needed to win game two in order to have a real chance in the series. I'm still torn on whether, I don't think this was like a template, a rock solid thing in terms of like, oh, they're going to win, you know, this game and then three more in quick succession and it's going to be, you know, anything like that. But it was also a reminder of how dependent Denver is on their, not necessarily even Jokic, but their other players playing relatively close to their standard. This was a bad Michael Porter Jr. game on both ends of the floor. KCP didn't really do anything offensively and had all these devastating fouls. And so the idea, whether you want to credit the Heat with that or the Nuggets with it, that putting more pressure on those players to succeed on offense and defense is somewhat perilous at times for Denver, and it is a good path for Miami to potentially win games, whether it's one this game or whether it's all four in the series.
Wherever the road may take you, Discount Tire and Continental Tire get you there safely with the perfect combination of style, comfort, and price. Get a set of Continental tires at your local Discount Tire store or online at discounttire.com. Discount Tire, let's get you taken care of.
Are you waking up with a ton of back pain or shoulder pain or neck pain? The number one reason probably to consider is your mattress. Maybe it's time for a new mattress. And I highly recommend that you check out Helix Sleep, which you can do risk-free with their 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty, depending on the model. And they have 20 unique mattresses, the award-winning Lux, the Ultra Premium Elite Collections. They have Helix Plus, which is designed for big and tall sleepers. Helix Kids, endorsed by child sleep experts. You can take their 2-minute sleep quiz. That's what my wife and I did over 10 years ago now. We still have a number of Helix Sleep mattresses that we've gotten over the years, and we are extremely satisfied with them even now, 10 years later. You might be like, you know, I kind of want to try it out beforehand. Going to the store is not really going to give you any information. You're going to be like, lay down, like, oh, do I take off my shoes? Maybe I should leave my shoes on, but then I got to have my feet hanging off the mattress because I can't leave my shoes on and sleep normally on this mattress. And then you're going to feel awkward laying there after about 30 seconds. Like, you can't determine anything in 30 seconds. So you're going to have to take it home, and you might as well just get it delivered straight to your door and utilize that 100-night trial. And there's never been a better time to use Helix because they are offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. You can go to helixsleep.com/capspace. Use the remote /capspace. We talk about all the time here on the program. That's helixsleep.com/capspace. This is their best offer yet. It won't last long with Helix. Better sleep starts now. Yeah, the Heat formula, we can kind of throw out the Knicks series because the Knicks just didn't have enough offensively throughout large swaths of that series, and also Jimmy was hurt. But the Heat formula, make fewer mistakes than their opponents.
And in this one, that's actually one point I wanted to get to is that the run that Denver had, and I mean, we were talking about this live, the run that Denver had at the start of the second quarter, no Butler, no Jokic, felt fluky at the time. And a big part of why I've always been skeptical of Denver's offensive process during the non-Jokic minutes, and it's defied my expectations pretty consistently in this postseason, including at times in the Lakers series and in the second round too. But part of why that run was so successful was because Miami had a series of live ball turnovers, which were a mix of forced and unforced. And I think we now have enough in the 8-quarter sample, that was more unusual. And so getting those turnovers in the second quarter of game two, Denver had 4 steals. They had 0 in the first quarter. They had 4 then, and they ended up with 7 in the entire game. So they had more in that beginning stretch of the second quarter than the whole rest of the game combined. And if Miami's not giving those up, it's harder to beat them.
Yeah, so that's a big part of the formula, is making fewer mistakes, both in terms of the game plan. And Michael Malone was just savaging their game plan discipline after the game and their effort. So play harder, make fewer mistakes, and then make great plays. Plays that are not, quite frankly, expected from these players. That are, they almost don't make sense. That's been the way that it's been. But, I mean, this is now, I think they've just dropped under 50% from three with that last Butler step back, but they're on pace for, I think, their 5th or 6th 50% shooting game from three in these playoffs. And the one thing you can point to for Denver is that Butler still hasn't gone crazy. But Duncan Robinson can give them some strategic issues at some point. The Heat of it have cleaned up the Denver passes to the paint out of their split cut action. They're kind of used to that now. They're at least Denver's not just, okay, Jokic is going to stand there at the elbow, we'll set some screens, we're going to get a dunk. That's over now. Jokic is a great passer, but for whatever reason, that's the Heat have managed to avoid those situations. And I thought they did a better job of attacking Jokic. I think that can even be improved more. They did a good job of getting Jamal Murray onto Jimmy Butler. I think that's just important, not even necessarily because it's it's so much better offense than Aaron Gordon, who defends Butler exceedingly well. But it's also just to tire out Murray, tire out Jokic a little bit, make them, even if it's just mentally more tiring to know that you're going to be in every action and you can't just concentrate only on offense. That's pretty massive. So certainly Miami's not going to shoot 50% from three every game. They might do it every other game. And those ones, they're going to be in pretty decent position. Now, if you're Denver, you take heart that they haven't really stopped you yet, even in this game where they, in theory, played better defense. In terms of adjustments, I would love to get into some Murray and Gordon pick and roll with Kevin Love guarding Aaron Gordon. That's just not really something that they've done. Generally, Gordon is being guarded by someone who will just switch onto Murray. They haven't really explored any of that at all. Kevin Love, you're going to put 2 on the ball with him. And Aaron Gordon, he can make a play going downhill, or you could just even try to short the pick and roll with Jokic as well. You don't want to be in rotation and Nikola Jokic isn't even involved in that action. So I think they should try to hammer that more with Love. Get Love away from the basket, but make him guard on ball as the screen defender. Put him in space more, because for a lot of these guys, even someone when it was AD on Gordon, even that worked, I thought, reasonably well. But AD, at least he's capable of switching onto the ball handler, which Love just is not. They're not going to want to do that. So that's something that I would try to look at as well. I think getting Porter Jr. going early in the game is really essential. Just try to run some plays for him, maybe even for him to get some quick duck-ins or something. Try to involve him in some of the screening action a little bit more, because if I'm not saying Miami isn't respecting him, but if he just hits a couple to get going early, that'll be really big for his confidence. It'll be big for his defense. If I'm Miami, I'm going to continue to work off ball screening actions and split cuts using Porter Jr., making him guard, make decisions, communicate. That's the biggest thing that he struggled with. I thought overall that they were pretty good, though. They seemed relatively optimized in terms of their defensive strategy. I don't really have much else to say for that on Miami's standpoint.
I don't either. I think I'm just about done.
All right, welcome back, and please stay tuned here for a sneak preview of our more than hour-long discussion on Victor Wembanyama, available exclusively on Dunked On Prime. But I thought we'd give you at least a little bit of a flavor of it, and you can hopefully sign up using our special sale in honor of the mock-off season and, of course, all the other content that we've had as well. Enjoy. The time has come to talk about the generational prospect, Victor Wembanyama. Don't worry, we'll try to put him into some perspective as a prospect at the end here. But why don't we start with the biographical information for the man from France?
Unfortunately, because his team is still currently playing in the French playoffs, congratulations, Metropolitans 92 actually made the French finals. Today, they will play Monaco, and that series weirdly doesn't start for another week. So that could actually run until very close to the draft, which may end up affecting his Wembanyama's availability in summer league. Anyway, besides that, so we don't have combine measurements for Wembanyama, but approximately, and these are going to sound ludicrous because they are, Wembanyama roughly 7'4" barefoot, 230 pounds, with an 8-foot wingspan and about a 10-foot standing reach. Yes, that is the height of the basket. And Wembanyama, he's born January 4th of 2004, which means he was 4 days short of being in last year's draft. Sorry, Orlando. And it means that his rookie year will be Wembanyama's age 20 season in the NBA, based on the way Basketball Reference does it. There really aren't physical comps. I like going through this. It's a part of my exercise now. Thanks to the NBA for maintaining a combine measurements database. You can go through it and compare it year to year. It's not searchable very well, but like you could pick a kind of a filtering term and then get to it. There are really no comps for Victor Wembanyama physically. Gobert is about 3 inches shorter barefoot, and the standing reach is about 3.5 inches. No, sorry, he has a 7'8" standing reach. Victor Wembanyama is 8 feet. Yes, that is, and so like it's incredible. Like his physical tools are different than anyone else. Do you want me to do some bio stuff, or do you want to get somewhere else?
Yeah, let's get that out of the way.
Wembanyama's. I like to look into this if it's possible. His father was a track athlete, and his mom played basketball, now coaches. And Wembanyama, I love this story. This is in his wiki. Wembanyama entered the youth system of Nanterre 92 at 10 years old because someone saw him on the bench in an under-11 game and thought he was a coach because he was almost 6 feet tall at that point. Actually played, which I didn't know this, on the Barcelona youth team in under-14s, but then started playing professionally back with Nanterre when he was 15 in 2019-20, and then really started with their senior team a year later. And that's when he suffered a stress fracture in his fibula, missed a couple of months there, and then he played for Tony Parker's team for a year, and then opted out and joined Metropolitan 92, where Boris Diaw is team president, in part to play under French national team coach Vincent Collet, who is the head coach of Metropolitan 92. And then we can do the basic stats on it. So Victor Wembanyama, 19 years old, playing against professionals, even if the French league is far from the greatest in professional basketball. 21 points, 9 rebounds, 3 blocks, 2.5 assists, about a steal a game, 3 turnovers in 32 minutes per game. 25 PER, if you like that.
Oh, so let's start with that physical profile. And you mentioned, I just laughed. I was muted, but I laughed when you said, yes, that is the height of the basket for his standing reach. And some guys, you'll see their measurements and you're like, ah, come on, that's not true. Or like, yeah, where is that? I'm surprised it's that big. I'm not surprised.
No.
As you watch him, and he covers, not only is he just like a huge standing reach guy, he covers so much ground. He is quick. The guy can move. His short area quickness, taking a couple of steps. For example, if he gets beaten by a guard on a switch, he can track back. He'll get a ton of blocks to bother the guy. If he's guarding someone on the perimeter, standing at the foul line, and something happens behind him, he can just get back and erase that shot. He blocks shots that nobody else in the world can block. And that is just so bothersome for the opposition. Guys, you know, jump hook shots by opposing post players and jump shots on the perimeter. I might transition into talking about his rim protection here, but the way he moves his feet is incredible as well. I mean, he really, you know, a couple of slides, like it's really hard to like blow by this guy. And certainly the strength needs to get better, as we talk about the physical profile. And they've fastidiously, you mentioned he had that stress fracture. Since then, he's gotten into this routine where he works on his feet. He does this whole crazy warm up. And there are a lot of good articles on this if you want to hear more about it. But basically, they don't want him to put on too much weight too quickly. You know, he definitely looks thin, but he doesn't look, you know, like Sean Bradley thin, Manute Bol thin. Like, he looks like he has like a body that could belong to a basketball player.
Can I give you a short thing on that? So I saw Wembanyama twice in France. The first one of those, I went with my wife, and we were three rows off their bench. And the first thing she said is, she's like, "Oh, he's a lot thicker than Chet Holmgren, because we saw him last year." And like, that is a salient point here, is that his legs are just, you know, he's not like little deer legs. They're a little bigger than that. They're not huge, but you know, it's important.
Yeah, so he certainly can be overpowered. Like, he's not, he doesn't really use his strength. Guys can get underneath him a ton. You know, I mean, that's all to be expected for any big who's 19, but particularly one who's 7'5". But yeah, I mean, the wingspan is crazy. He also has extremely quick hands, I would say, which gets, when you have quick hands and you have an 8-foot wingspan, that's a pretty nice combination. He'll get a lot of steals in isolation too, like picking guys' dribbles in ways that they don't expect.
He had a hilarious one, I have it in my notes, where he forced a steal. He got a deflection, which became a steal, on a player he wasn't even guarding on the perimeter. He was just like, oh, I can get there, and just put his hand there, and the guy's just like, what just happened? Like, because it feels impossible at times, the plays that he can get to. And the other thing that Wembanyama has now, this, and I think of this as part of the physical profile, like, his feet are very good. He does get beat by guards, but he has an understanding of how space works. And this will in some ways be even more compelling in the NBA because there are more shooters now, and just things are a little bit different, where you don't have to get back in front of the guy if you have stretch Armstrong arms and can just block, contest, or affect the shot from another position. And he's so long that some of the old, like, KD defending James Harden stuff works too, where he's affecting things even from a suboptimal position, and he understands that and doesn't force it. He understands that getting back in front opens up the risk of a foul, and for a 19-year-old to put all that together is jaw-dropping.
Yeah, we'll hit on his rim protection more, and I guess this, maybe it doesn't count technically as rim protection, but I watched, I think he had over 100 blocks in the season. I watched 38 of them. 9 of them were on jump shots. 8 of them were on three-pointers. And most of those taking place in either closeout situations or one-on-one situations. He was very comfortable switching late in the clock. In fact, even I think, like, he was probably their best switch defender. And
he was.
He would even seek out the chance to switch late in the clock. The one block that I'll try to describe it to you, by this, like, 6-foot guard, and not really that athletic. There's some pretty good athletes at times in the French League. This guy was not one of them. But it's late clock, and this guy's maybe, like, you know, the arc there is 22 feet. This guy's maybe standing at 24 feet. I would say Victor is maybe standing, he's standing at least 6 feet away from the guy. And which is, that's like, remember, like, when you talk about the NBA tracking data, open is considered 4 to 6 feet away, and wide open is further than 6 feet. But this guy's like, this is Victor Wembanyama. I better make sure I can get my shot off. I'm going to take 2 steps back. And Victor still blocks his 3 anyway.
He had one.
It was insane.
It was in the game I saw in person against Paola Cortez, where I just started cackling. Like, he blocked a 3-pointer. There's a very nice French media member sitting next to me, and he kind of, I said, I'm like, this doesn't happen. Like, this isn't a thing that occurs. And he's doing this against professional athletes. Like, this isn't. There was at one point, I have this in my notes, that I'm like, some of these plays look like that Zion Williamson middle school clips where he's just crushing tiny people, except that it's against professional athletes. And that is meant no disrespect to the competitors in France, many of whom you guys would know. Monaco has a number of players. I don't know if we'll get that deep into some of the stuff we watched, but it's like, he just exists on kind of a different plane physically than even those guys.
So many of these blocks, and this happens around the rim too, come when guys just aren't expecting it, when he's crashing down from the free throw line. The strategy against him most of the time was, unless you had one of your absolute best players was a center, you had to just go 5 out against him, or you probably weren't going to score. Or you could try to just get a bunch of Gortat screens, be physical with him, try to wall him off through. He didn't deal with that incredibly well. Yeah, how quickly he reacts to the ball was pretty incredible. The amount of ground that he covers in just those 2 steps. He's not necessarily doing a lot of pre-rotating, and that's something that he'll probably be able to do a little more in the NBA, where it's just, even seeing him and intimidating him will, or his intimidation will prevent guys from even considering penetrating. And but even when he's not getting there, he only had a, that I saw, a couple of plays where he just went vertical, the guys went into his chest, but he doesn't need to get there. And the other thing that's to really bother them, he can get shots in the air, he can get shots out of guys' hands. You try a scoop shot, there are a bunch of times when guys, guards would do the move where they accelerate really fast, try to get him moving backwards, stop on a dime, pump fake, and then turn back and shoot a fadeaway. He would block that shot pretty regularly. And he really is out of position a fair amount of time. I think he largely played hard. We'll talk more about that. And he's got pretty good instincts, but he also is just still 19 years old playing as a big man. That's one of the hardest positions to play defensively, but he still gets guys. And so I mentioned also when he's in a switch, guys blow by him. He's able to block it from behind. My one quibble that I had in terms of rim protection is he doesn't use his left hand often enough to block shots. I think he could get to even more if he did that. But he can also jump really quickly and get up to where he needs to be. Walker Kessler does this too, but he'll be on either another level of not needing to load up to jump. He can kind of just keep his arms up, kind of bent slightly above his head, and just get off the ground and go block something pretty easily. So it's really, he's the best pure shot blocker that I've ever seen. He gets blocks that nobody else has ever been able to get to. He has the potential to be the greatest defensive player of all time. Like that, there's just no two ways about that, I'd say.
Of the players that I've scouted closely, the only person defensively on film who's even close to comparable is Anthony Davis. And I loved AD's defensive film. In some ways, from a, like, just not necessarily an entertainment, but just like, oh, he's really got it down. Like, Anthony Davis might have been better there. But Wembanyama's tools and like the way the things that he does wrong, generally speaking, are pretty improvable. Like, it's not these fundamental weaknesses. And there will be times, you know, I'm sure there'll be, oh, it's going to be hard for him on Jokic and Embiid. But a couple things there. One, there are very few of those players in the league. And you can solve that riddle other ways. Like, and I was thinking a lot during one of the Monaco games I was watching about how the template that we saw, I'll use the MVP duel game, which in many ways kind of solidified Joel Embiid's MVP, where they were using PJ Tucker in that. Well, you can do something to that effect with Wembanyama if he can't handle the matchup, and I think that he will do better than most at those power games as well.
Yeah, we could talk about his post defense in a second, but I wanted to relay to you what I actually thought was the most impressive stat of any that I saw.
Okay.
2.2 fouls per game in like 30 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, he had 2.2 fouls and he had well more than that in terms of blocks. Like, he averaged 2.9 blocks per game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely insane. A 19-year-old big who's thin like this too. Usually that leads to a lot of fouling. And he's able to back off. He doesn't feel like he has to play with power too much. And so he's able to avoid fouling. But he doesn't need to use his body. He can just get there over the top from basically any angle.
He trusts his size better than any prospect I've ever seen, ever.
Yeah, I think maybe I saw him got beat on a pump fake once and commit a foul. I'd probably watch three full games worth, and then I watched a bunch of defensive clips too. So in the post, all but the biggest brutes just have no chance against him. Monaco starts Donatas Mata-Yunas. That's the best team in the league. That's who they're going to play in the final. And Mata-Yunas, I watched the first half of the game they got blown out in. But Mata-Yunas, he tried to post him up, I think, four times and got four shots blocked. Like, he just had no chance. Like, a guy who's probably actually a pretty good post player in Europe, a guy like that just can't even get a shot against him. Now, the one guy who gave him the most trouble is from the team they just beat, Asvel. And look up this guy's name, just because I have to say it, because I'll never get a chance to say it again, because this guy was actually like slight Victor Kryptonite. Yes, Yusufa Fall.
Oh, yeah, Yusufa Fall.
And remember, Victor played for Asvel last year. I would imagine he went up against Fall a fair amount. And Fall is the one guy who, like, if he tried to really duck him in, Fall has two moves. He's basically has a very, very short range left shoulder hook and just like a back you in for a dunk. But he scored on Victor pretty easily. He was really the only guy that was able to do it regularly. And that was mostly just getting great position beforehand. And his secret was push him so far into the basket that if he puts his hand up, he's putting his hand up through the rim. And he dunked on Victor a couple of times. Like, there might be something psychological there with having gone up against this guy in practice and gotten beaten on. But they also just beat Asvel 3-1 in the French League semifinals. What did you make of his motor defensively?
not terrible, but not fantastic. I thought that I count this as part of Motor, and I believe you do too. Wembanyama, he changes ends better going from defense to offense than offense to defense. Very common for young players in particular, because going to offense is way more fun. But those sorts of plays, sometimes there was a little bit of trouble there. There were times where he, like, in some ways you could argue there that he, I think overall it's a net positive where he doesn't go for as much as a lot of other guys. You could think about like the young bigs who jump for every pump fake and everything like that. But there were times where it felt like he could have gotten out there like for a closeout, or he could have gotten back into a play and didn't. So it's a very faint concern.
Yeah, I think there were times when it looked really good on either end. I thought that in the last game I watched, I watched two of these games against Osvald, at least a half of each of them, I thought he looked a little bit worn down. The format there is close to every other day, when they've basically been playing once a week. Other than that, that's part of it, because this team is not in the EuroLeague. We can talk a little bit more about the situation in a moment, but Mezzanine 2 is not in the EuroLeague, so he didn't have to play as many games. Ended up playing about 40 games on the season, and we'll have a few more in the French League final. It's a five-game series against Monaco coming up. And just a lot of possessions where he didn't venture inside the arc, really, on offense. Not a great motor, I would say, going after rebounds, particularly on the offensive end. That's not necessarily his role. His role is to be a big scorer on this team. So I don't know how, certainly when he's around the rim and like he has a free run at it, he's just going to crush anything that's around there. But on the defensive glass, I thought that he could just kind of get stuck boxing out. Like, he didn't like not box out, but there also wasn't a ton of rebounding out of area. He does have a nice faculty if he can get free for just kind of tipping the ball to himself, which is a neat trick when you've got a 10-foot standing reach. But I would say the biggest thing to me that I mean it's not really a concern, but he didn't look to me the part of someone who's going to be a dominant rebounder, at least not right away. And so yeah, it was kind of hit or miss. I thought that most of his errors that he made were errors of commission rather than omission. It wasn't just like, oh, somebody drove and he just never rotated, right? Do you feel differently on that? Like, I didn't see any of these plays where it's like if he didn't get there was usually a reason.
I agree with that. That's fair.
Like, he would be screened off by someone on a Gortat screen or posting up or like guarding a shooter or something. You wouldn't see guys drive from the opposite side. He'd be the low man and just not react. Like, that almost never happened.
He never went full Aiden.
Yeah. Pick and roll defense, he did a fair amount of switching. Also, teams didn't go with a pick and roll big against him a lot either, because they were trying to space him out. So there was a lot more switching being done, but I thought his feet were really good in pick and roll. He was active. He's got active hands. He would fake towards the ball handler, retreat. Communication, he did a lot of communicating, a lot of pointing stuff out. Was clearly very vocal, had an understanding of what they're trying to do. I want to give you a couple more stats on the isolation and post-up game. Post-ups, there's like a couple of guys who could go at him. Basically, everyone else was hopeless. It was like 0.7 points per possession. Isolations, opponents were 5 of 23 on isolations with some turnovers, specifically on isolations from the top, like off the dribble, usually by guards. 11 possessions, opponents were 0 for 6, and I think just about all those were blocked. 3 turnovers, some of those just directly caused by him. One guy traveled when he got up in the air and then just realized he couldn't get a shot off and just landed. And then the only points that he gave up were on 2 reach-in fouls in 11 possessions. Gave up 0 field goals. So you just saw, and if you go back to, we talked about Scoot Henderson, I'm actually much more impressed now. Again, the French League, Europe in general, is not known for like unbelievably athletic shot creating guards. Like Mike James, remember him? He played for Phoenix, a little bit in Brooklyn. It's probably, I would say, like the most dynamic shot creating guard, plays for Monaco. And James, he stopped James a couple of times, like picked his pocket. James hit like a really deep three on him another time when it was just like he didn't even dribble. He just shot a 30 footer over him. But the fact that Scoot was even able to like attack the basket and score a layup over him, or got like hit like a couple of shots, even though Wembanyama blocked him a couple times, like that was actually like easily the most impressive performance that any guard had going against him in isolation that I saw. So I think that's about all I've got on the defense. If he doesn't become just like a defensive player of the year, like all-time great defender, what would the reason for that be?
I mean, beyond injuries.
Yeah, of course.
There is an athleticism gap between the French league and the NBA. And I think some of the stuff that he gets away with because of how much longer he is, the timing, like the timing windows are harder against Ja Morant than they are against Mike James. And Mike James is one of the better creators in the French league. And so that, I think there will be a learning curve with Wembanyama. Now that, I think that's more of an age 20 versus an age 24 problem there.
I think everyone else is going to have more of a learning curve against him than he's going to have.
Totally fair.
Okay, that will do it for this sneak preview of the Wembanyama discussion. If you want to get the rest of it, of course, it is available exclusively on Dunked On Prime. I exhort you again to please consider subscribing if you enjoy this podcast. Never a better time of year. We have that special sale for a year-long membership that saves you a ton off the monthly price, and you can get all of our scouting reports, all of our gamers right after the finals are over. Draft analysis, free agency analysis, summer league analysis, every relevant player in summer league we will do a scouting report on. So please join us for the rest on Dunked On Prime. Link is in the show notes.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.